About a year ago, I was sitting down with a friend getting an education on investing. I was the student and he was the master. There was a glimmer in his eye as he shared about some of his success stories and about the lessons that he learned over time. Like a seasoned chess player, he carefully described the ups and downs of the stock market. And he went on to share of a couple of opportunities he took when a sudden drop in the value of a company didn't look quite right. The news was buzzing about a decision that caused the company's stock to drop suddenly, but my friend wasn't buying it. "It's just noise," he said. So he put his money where his mouth was and turned a quick profit. "It was just noise," he said. I've been thinking a lot about that word lately, noise. Things would have been pretty quiet if a pandemic like this had struck 150 years ago. We now have endless ways to connect, even in our isolation. But do they all add value? Could we do without the 24-hour news cycle constantly craving our attention? Would our lives be worse off if we couldn't express our opinions to a bunch of people that we used to know at the click of a mouse? Would I be less happy if I couldn't read about all the people who refuse to wear face masks on my community's Facebook page? And don't get me wrong, the ability to see my mom connect face-to-face with her granddaughter from over 1,000 miles away is awesome. The ability to grieve with distant friends over the loss of a loved one adds meaning. But some of it feels empty. And often, when we're looking for a connection, we just find noise. To be honest, it's caused me to do a little self-reflection the past few days. It's a lot easier to point out the noise when it's coming from somewhere else. But what about me? Am I making the world a better place when I step into the conversation? Am I good for the world? Or am I just good for me? Perhaps you found yourself looking at your life and wondering the same things. You hear about all the good that healthcare workers are doing on the front lines, and you'd love to help. But you're locked at home because you're at risk. You want to be a part of the story instead of being the one who consumes it all the time. Whether you're a teacher trying to press through these final weeks of the school year or a student trying to make sense of this new world that we live in, whether you're a grandparent considering how you might pass along your legacy to grandchildren, whether you're a mom concerned about the world you're raising your kids in, or a business owner worried that you're going to have to let some people go, I'm really glad that you're listening in today wherever you're at. That's because I'm sure, like me, you want your life to mean something, even in these difficult days. Is it possible that even in this strange space, you can be someone who offers something good instead of someone who contributes to the noise? Fortunately for us, we aren't the first people that had questions like these. During the Apostle Peter's last days, he looked upon a young group of Christians he'd invested in with grave concern. So instead of a warm farewell, Peter passes along a clear warning: watch out for the noise. A group of former Christians began to doubt the words of the apostles and the ancient writings handed down to them about Jesus coming back. I can see Peter lower in his seat as he read the report. Many of these men and women were followers of another great church leader, the Apostle Paul. But now Paul was gone, beheaded by the Roman government. And so they had started to doubt these glorious promises that Paul had made about Jesus coming back soon. If he's not coming to rescue us from all this, what's the point? And who can blame them? Chances are there's been a time in your life when you counted on God to pull you out of a bad situation or to help you in a time of need, and he didn't come through in the way that you expected. Unsettled questions can easily sour into bitter conclusions, and that's exactly what happened. They rejected the goodness of God and turned to the rest of the Christians there to invite them to do the same. It's in this precarious place that we find Peter share these words. He opens up his letter with a reminder about God's divine power and his invitation to participate in his divine nature. And then he continues in 2 Peter 1:5-7. For this reason, make every effort to add these things to your lives: goodness by your faith, knowledge by your goodness, self-control by your knowledge, perseverance by your self-control, godliness by your perseverance, mutual affection by your godliness, and love by your mutual affection. Full disclosure, if you happen to be reading that verse in your own Bible, you might have read something a little different, like add faith to your goodness instead of add goodness by your faith. Some of you at home might be thinking, wait, what? The Bible is a translation? Yes, the Bible is a translation from ancient Greek, Hebrew, and Aramaic, depending upon which part. And that's something that you shouldn't be afraid of. In fact, that's something that should give you confidence that we're dealing with something ancient and very special that has been passed down through the test of time. It was written and passed down even before English was a language, and that's pretty cool. But don't all the different translations prove that the Bible is inaccurate? No, not at all. Just because a translation differs doesn't mean that the text behind it differs. Unfortunately, there's no such thing as a perfect translation, because every language can be vague at times. If I say the kid beat the old man with a stick, I could mean one of two things: either a kid used a stick to beat an old man, or a kid beat an old man who had a stick. So sometimes the meaning isn't clear. But fortunately for us, we have so much Bible that what is unclear in one place can be made clear by looking at similar passages. Reading multiple translations can help us uncover some sayings that might be a little vague and help us to, and give us a great starting point to dig into something that's ancient and unchanging. In this case, scholars say that the best understanding of the original language here is add goodness by faith instead of add goodness to faith. Wow, that seems like a small difference, you might say. Well, what's the big deal? Well, it turns out that little words can make a big difference. The story of the Bible teaches that faith is all important. It is by grace that you have been saved through faith, the Apostle Paul said. And this is not from yourselves. It is the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. What that means is that God rescued us free of charge, not because we were perfect or all fixed up or because we did anything good to deserve it. He rescued us because of his character and his kindness. And the only thing that we can do is believe. Believing God or trusting him means to completely rely on him. It's an act of allegiance and dependence. And that's really the only thing that we can do. It's all sufficient. If I read Paul and then I turn around to read Peter that we need to add to our faith, that it in fact needs something more, then it sounds like they are kind of saying two different things. But Peter and Paul are on the same team. Peter isn't saying that at all. What he's actually saying complements what Paul says. Just as our faith is a hand that reaches out to be rescued by God, our faith is a hand that reaches out to receive God's goodness. And that goodness grows. Faith produces goodness, which produces knowledge. You see, real knowledge depends on moral character, because bad character warps facts to fit a person's narrative. True or good knowledge produces self-control, because the power of self-control is a truth to look forward to. Self-control produces perseverance, because it enables a person to say no and keep going. Perseverance produces godliness or devotion to God, because perseverance refuses to buy into the lie that our life's disappointments define who God is. And that closeness to God helps us become closer to people, which produces a desire to put others before ourselves. Faith, goodness, knowledge, self-control, perseverance, godliness, affection, love. But it all starts with faith. God loves to occupy empty spaces. When our hearts say, I need you and I trust you, he fills that void with his divine power for divine change. When our hearts say, I got this, or I'm good, we're left to our own devices. Who can perform surgery on their own heart? No one. But that doesn't keep us from trying. When people think of faith, they often think of a specific collection of ideas or customs that distinguish them from others. Faith can and does mean that. But the faith that Peter invites his readers to revisit is something more. Your faith isn't just something that defines you. It's something that shapes you. Trusting God makes us good. It's the kind of thing that elevates our lives, whether we serve on the front lines or are stuck at home. It enables us to experience God's life and goodness in our innermost parts as He heals us and makes us into something new. But maybe you're watching today and thinking to yourself, that's exactly the problem. There are too many religious people that talk about good for others, but only appear to be seeking good for themselves. Aren't there enough people out there whose only concern is to escape from the world? People who huddle away without concern for their neighbors? People who vote in ways that are only beneficial to themselves? It might conjure up pictures of Buddhist priests in the Himalayas who can stay isolated in the mountains for 7 months of the year. Or perhaps an image of a Christian monk comes to mind who spends all of their time tending their gardens and in prayer. Trusting God might make someone good on the inside, but what good is that? It turns out that it's the greatest kind of good. Peter continues in verse 8, "For if you possess these qualities in increasing measure, they will keep you from being ineffective and unproductive in your knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ." You see, the more and more we trust God to make us good, the more and more we add value to the world. That's why Peter's chain of production climaxes with love, and not just the kind of brotherly love that we have for someone who has been kind to us. Striving towards goodness through faith ends in other-centered, selfless love, the kind of love that only God can give us. It turns out that God's good inside of us is good for the world. What does that good look like in a time like this? Even when actions have been limited, Christ Church has responded in creative and meaningful ways over the past few weeks. Many of you have put time aside to help shop for groceries, while others of you have offered medical advice or made masks for people in the medical field as a part of an effort to love New Hampshire. It turns out that there is a lot of good that we can do in a time like this. But let me suggest that perhaps one of the greatest tools for good we can use is a part of the body many consider the least, the tongue. It's one of the most powerful weapons we have. "Kids who cry sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me," are ironically using words in their own defense. That's because words are powerful. Chances are that if someone told you that you are ugly or stupid, those searing words stuck in your head. And you might even remember some of them from childhood. On the other hand, maybe you also remember the words of a teacher who encouraged you to keep developing your art skills because of all the raw talent you had. Maybe you still treasure in your heart the first time someone outside of your family told you that they loved you. Our words have the power to give life and take it away. The recent film, A Hidden Life, records the true story of a soft-spoken Austrian farmer who faced the threat of execution for refusing to swear allegiance to Hitler during World War II. After a tense tribunal, one of the court justices pulls Franz into his private quarters to probe him. "Do you imagine that anything you do will change the course of the war?" "No one will change." But no response comes from Franz's lips. His refusal to honor Hitler wasn't a publicity stunt. It wasn't an effort to start a movement. The justice's eyes shift uncomfortably as he probes a little deeper. "Do you judge me?" The farmer's eyes move back and forth as he carefully selects his words. "I don't judge you. I'm not saying Hitler is wicked and I am right. I don't know everything. A man may do wrong and he can't get out of it to make his life clear. Maybe he'd like to go back, but he can't. But I have this feeling inside of me that I can't do what I believe is wrong." "Do you have a right to do this?" the justice presses. Franz looks down at the ground while gathering his thoughts. "Do I have a right not to?" In this otherworldly scene, we get a glimpse of a man for all seasons, one the world is not worthy of. He stands with truth, and yet mercy pours from his lips. Our culture has embraced Hitler as the paragon of evil, and yet this man is even unwilling to be his judge. I don't know about you, but sometimes I want to kick back in this new digital space so many of us live in. I want to cry out in anger when I see some injustice on social media. I want to call someone out when I see some overreaction or falsehood. I want to express my frustration when I see people support a movement only when it's trendy. And maybe you feel the same way. And in this time where tensions and suspicions are high about the pandemic and social distancing, isn't it even more difficult to hold back? Certainly, it's okay to be angry. In fact, it's right to be angry sometimes. But don't we kind of pick and choose what we're going to be angry about? Author Philip Yancey wrote, "Christians get very angry toward other Christians who sin differently than they do." That made me curious about Jesus. In a Christianity Today article entitled, "When Jesus Got Angry," Carl Vaters writes, "Jesus' anger was never pointedly outward toward the world. Yet he lived in a time when the prevailing political and military climate was about as evil and despotic as any time in history, when morality was debased beyond the comprehension of almost any of us. He literally had a confrontation with the devil himself and didn't respond angrily." So when did Jesus cross the line? Jesus got upset with his followers at times and was very angry with some of the religious leaders of his day. Was it self-righteousness? Was it hypocrisy? Did Jesus just have a particular distaste for some evil deeds? There's a common thread throughout all of them. In fact, it's at the heart of Peter's own letter, false teaching. It wasn't that religious leaders of Jesus' day were worse than the thieves, prostitutes, and murderers. It was that by saying one thing and living differently, they misled the masses into doing the same. Jesus' expressions of anger were carefully selected to keep people safe. They weren't targeted calls against specific sins. If he had raged against every sin, how would he have ever stopped raging? They were warnings against dangerous traps. So there's a place for anger in our public discourse, but let me invite you to consider that for the most part, that's rare. That's because at the heart of God's goodness in this time and place is an extension of his kindness, mercy, love, and hope. And that's to every sinner, no matter their preferred method of sinning. We have seen some tremendous acts of goodness, and we have watched communities rally in the past weeks. I cannot predict when the church will come back together again, but I do have another prediction. The longer this goes on, the more the public discourse is going to get worse. Friends, we don't have to be that way. And we can be God's good for the world by speaking good into the world. What would it be like if your words were so carefully chosen that all of the noise paused to listen when you spoke? Can you imagine more people turning to you for counsel because they experienced the very goodness and beauty of God in doing so? These are challenging times for the world and for the church that's in it, but they can also be opportunities to shine with a bright and everlasting hope by the words that we speak. Perhaps our words won't fit the narrative. Yeah, maybe we'll frustrate people by not joining in their rallying cry, but the world needs men and women of all seasons more than ever. And by experiencing the good of God by faith, you can be God's good for the world as you speak his good into it. This week, some big news came out of the Supreme Court. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking about that toilet flush that came from one of the justices who was teleconferencing in. Articles have been written trying to solve the mystery. They're calling it the flush heard round the world. But that's not what I'm talking about. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas spoke. The justice is famous for almost never asking questions in court proceedings. In 2019, the New York Times said he broke a 3-year hiatus. Now I get it. Some of you might disagree with Justice Thomas's positions, and there are judicial reasons behind his silence. But when the man speaks, everyone listens and the media goes crazy. He could be talking about something as inconsequential as trademarking a 1-800 plumbing number, and it's going to make headlines. What if your words were so valuable to the world that they rose above the noise and brought healing to your friends, your family, and everyone you are connected with? Could it be that you could make a difference by letting the goodness of God pass through your lips? The world is facing so much brokenness now, and so much of the brokenness that was already there is bubbling to the surface. We can use something as small as words to build it up again.